Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's now hour number two. It's the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Ah, sanity. It's a real difficult one to hold on to. It's kind of like paper gold assets, in a way. It doesn't really exist, does it?
No.
You know, it's can you understand, is there a difference between sanity and the perception of sanity? Because I know there's a hell of a lot of people around there who still haven't woken up, and they think that what they're doing is sane. You know, they're getting in their slave monkey suit, they're going to their slave job, stuck in the slave traffic, doing their slave work and what have you, and they think that they're sane, and they think that people with megaphones on the side of the street saying society is fracked are the crazy ones.
Yeah, you see, because in psychiatry and in psychology, there is actually no baseline for sanity. Nobody knows where sanity ends and insanity begins. It's purely an arbitrary, you know, transient line in the sand that means nothing really. You could have people who were alive in the 1920s, if they were brought into this world today, they would think this world was insane. And they'd probably be classified as being insane by psychiatry. For instance, years ago, people would be like less sort of guarded. There would be no political correctness, so they might be more open about their prejudices. Doesn't mean they're evil. It's just how the life was back then. Yet under the DSM today, they would be considered, you know, disabled, psychologically disordered, whatever, or psychiatrically affected. So there's no baseline to sanity and insanity. There just isn't. Now, there are, you can obviously see people who are definitely not well and they're not functioning in the society. And that's what annoys me, because those people are sick and those people are ill. But when somebody holds a different opinion or is eccentric or is, you know, a maverick in some way, this whole thing of you're nuts or you're insane is used as a social control mechanism.
Kind of like political correctness. I figured out that the problem, the whole agenda behind political correctness is to stop people saying what they really think.
Well, political correctness is fascism. I have nothing to do with people. Anyone comes into my life that has overt politically correct behaviours, I know I'm dealing with an absolute muppet. I will have nothing to do with them, because if they're dishonest in their feelings that way, they're dishonest in every other aspect of life. So, for instance, if they're looking for misogynists and homophobes and racists everywhere, that shows me that they have a fascist nature. And also, if they're dishonest about that, they're dishonest about everything. That's one of my yardsticks for people. Anyone who is overtly politically correct is fundamentally at heart flawed, because a normal compassionate person knows it's wrong to walk up to a black person and say a racial term, or a Jewish person, or a gay person. You don't do that, okay? You don't do it. We know that. We know it would hurt their feelings, because the same. But a person who invokes political correctness, I believe, doesn't actually have those feelings, and they would say them if they didn't put their own brakes on themselves. So I do not trust people. It's the same thing with people who say we need religion in order to have morals. What? It's the same crappy argument.
Yeah. When you say that, it reminds me of a lot of the people that I've made videos for, even had on this radio show in the socialist wing in New Zealand here, some of them overtly politically correct, and then I've seen lots of other instances where they started to attack activists whom I respect, who have never done anything wrong, and lie about them and hold these little socialist kangaroo courts and what have you. So it's actually quite a profound realization that's just hit me because of what you said there.
Oh, yeah, I've had huge problems with socialists. And I've never met a socialist who was a worker. They all seem to be from wealthy or well-off families. They all seem to be doing quite well. To me, they are used as just bullies, as just thugs. The brown shorts of today are these sort of like anti-Nazi leagues, anti-this league, pro-black, you know, all these stupid kind of like white folks who think that they have to regulate other white folks. That crowd, I can't stand them, because they're thugs. Because again, they don't have, you know, decency. So therefore, they assume the rest of us don't have it either. And we have to be regulated by them because they've discovered decency in the same way a born-again Christian has discovered Jesus.
Yeah. In fact, that was funny. I remember I was at work one time and I had this really difficult customer who just wasn't being honest with me, you know, kind of thing. And all I wanted to do was get his phone bill faxed to me so that I could actually do a proper analysis of his phone bill. And so he was telling me how much I think his landlines were costing, that they were like $16 each. And I was like, that's not possible. They're at least $40 each. And I knew that we had like this digital version that where they were like $7 each. So I was like, you know what? This guy's probably not telling me the truth. So I'll tell you what, I'll just BS him a little just so that he can send me his bills so that I can actually go ahead and help him, you know, and actually try and do something for him. And I got the bill and I said, yeah, all right, thank God. A little bit of BS goes a long way when you can actually help people with it. And I think there was this born again Christian lady who said, "Oh, you don't have any conscience!" Like right in the middle of the floor of all these callers and everything, like really loudly in front of everybody. It's like, freaking hell! And then I pulled her aside into the staff room and I say, "Why did you say that?" She goes, "I didn't say it. I didn't say it." And then I go, "Yep, born again Christian."
Devil made her do it.
You know, it's when you deny your own faults, that's when you become truly faulty.
Exactly, because then you've denied your own humanity. You've denied, and then what happens is you become a kind of a police, a sort of a moral police of others, because what happens is you're no longer in control of yourself. I mean, I can honestly say the most politically correct people I've known were also among the most indecent I ever met. They had no decency in them.
Yeah. Well, I think I've got moral authority. I've captured the moral high ground. Yeah. Therefore, I can not have to abide by it myself and just tell everybody else to. That's totally hypocritical. It's what I call, and when born-agains do that, I call them hypocristians.
Hypocristians, yeah. It's like when they say, "What would Jesus do?" I tell you what they would. But if Jesus was around, he wouldn't do what you do.
Yeah,
it's what would you do if Jesus was there? He wouldn't. He wouldn't do anything what you're doing.
Nah, he probably wouldn't. He'd probably throw you out of the temple along with the bankers.
Yeah, he'd be on shows like this. I've no doubt about it.
Yeah.
If the real Jesus, if you can find him in that text, he was like a radical of his day. And he was ready for a showdown with the psychopathic control grid of the Roman Empire in his day, and in the temple, he was ready for a showdown.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is that possible in this day and age? Because I believe I mentioned this in the first segment about somebody who was kind of like really depressed and saying, "Oh, it's hopeless. We can give up and everything," and say, you know, kind of kill yourself if you think that your life isn't worth living. Stop contaminating the rest of us with your depression. But, you know, it was pretty callous of me, and I regret saying that, as I said. However, is it actually possible to override the system, right? And I thought about it like this. You know how when they tie down those old school Zeppelins or whatever in those big hangars, and they have ropes down on the front and on the back and in the middle and all over the place, right? They got all these different ropes and all these different points holding this one Zeppelin down. And I think that's kind of like how many ropes our minds or how many ropes our countries are bound under the psychopathic elite control structure. So that in order to release and allow your mind to float free or allow your country to be free, all of those ties have to be severed simultaneously. That means all your mind control has to be severed, or your poison food has to be severed, or the chemtrails have to be severed, the corruption, the banking system, and everything basically needs to be taken away simultaneously in order to get any form of freedom back. In order to accomplish this, though, it's what people have been calling the mass awakening. And I had my Facebook status the other day. In order to have critical mass, the masses have to be able to think critically.
They can't. Even many people in the alternative can't think critically. It's unfortunate, but they can't. They just become the second level of the control system. They jump up into the next level, and they're critical in a new sphere of a new paradigm. What they really have to do is be like a baby and start from fresh, that you know nothing, and you can't carry your baggage with you from before. But I've noticed that. I mean, recently I had a bit of a hullabaloo with the Russell Brand thing, which it wasn't bad for me in the end, but at first I was very badly attacked. And what I'd realized was these people had just gone from stage one to stage two, and they were still depending on an exterior figure to do it for them. And they assumed I was attacking Russell Brand personally. And if you listen to what I wrote and said, I didn't. I was talking about the stuff he was coming out with, which was, to me, it was like something Bono was coming, like just another celebrity talking through his backside. And so I said, hold on a second, and you shouldn't be externalizing this stuff. But then it made me read that was quite surprising. Now, I have to say, an awful lot of people stood by me as well, but it was quite surprising to me how hostile people who I thought were pretty cool and woken up and were no lot had broken from the Hollywood spell suddenly found that they had this Hollywood leader to follow. Now, that's not to say that some of the stuff he said didn't have merit. Absolutely, it did. But at the same time, too, he was on the BBC. He was, you know, I don't want to get into his personal life, but he's surrounded by bankers, basically. He has an awful lot of money, and he's asking for a redistribution of wealth. Well, why doesn't he give away lots of his money to begin with? You know, it's this kind of thing. And it just seemed to be another Bono, another Bob Geldof, another celebrity talking about this stuff. And I've come to see that there is an element of coaching, of activism among celebrities. But it was interesting for me how many people that I thought were woken up were still the spell of celebrity, the most powerful force on this earth, still had them.
I think it's because we've got this this complex that humans do like leaders. We like to be led, don't we? We like to look up to people.
Unfortunately.
We like to find good examples to follow. I mean, like, I got people who look up to me and what have you, and maybe that's not such a bad thing, but then again, at the same time, I'd rather them have faith in themselves than faith in me. You know what I'm saying? I think that's far more valuable. I'd rather somebody stop listening to my show and begin their own rather than listen to me for years and years and years without doing a single broadcast of their own. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to be your savior, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want to be your leader. I'm just trying to help you recognize that you don't need one and stop thinking that I am one just because I'm telling you that you don't need one.
Exactly. You should be your own leader. But at the same time, too, there's nothing wrong with being inspired. I'm inspired by fellas like you. I'm inspired by lots of people that are doing stuff that you're doing. But at the same time, too, you don't follow me, I don't follow you, but we both say, I like what he has to say about this, good, it's important, and I'll share it with other people. That's a different thing. What I don't like is the celebrity aspect, the worst, the sort of idolization, because somebody's famous and they're among the rich and famous, therefore he then has validated all those years of my friends and family thinking I was a nut because I said vaccines don't work. You know, that kind of a thing. And it becomes a compensatory mechanism. And therefore, you abdicate your own personal responsibilities as being a woken up person to your celebrity. And that's a dangerous road to go down. And all I wanted to do was say to people, put the brakes on. Just put the brakes on.
Yeah. Well, I think that's perfectly rational, isn't it? It reminds me of the album cover of a Korn album called Follow the Leader. And they got a hopscotch squares leading off of a cliff. And I'm thinking that's kind of what's happening now with celebrity culture and government, and a whole bunch of new political parties have started to come out and things like that, garnering people's support and what have you as an alternative to the mainstream. But it's just another mainstream alternative, for frick's sake. Why can't people see? It's all a scam. It's just a scam reinventing itself so it can continue to scam you. Sweet mother of mercy. Why can't you see it?
Yeah, no, it is. It's like, I even predicted in England a new left party was coming out. Sure enough, Unity left appeared. It was like I said, I should be in Las Vegas, like rolling the dice. It's got so predictable at this point. They just give us new scams to follow.
Yeah.
Same old rubbish.
Yeah, well, the parliamentary roundtable is a crap table, I'll give it that much. It does belong in Vegas, especially with all the gambling derivatives. Now, I was thinking, of course, that this element of a saviour complex, and you mentioned this word inspire, okay, inspiration. If somebody makes you feel happy to do nothing, that's not inspiration, okay? They're just entertainment. If somebody's words motivate you to stop doing what you're doing and course correct, that's inspiration. That's the kind of thing you should be looking for. Don't look for things that make you feel comfortable. Look for things that make you uncomfortable. Uncomfortable things make you change. Those things that you want to enjoy, the entertainment, the frivolity, whatever it is that you've got in your life that makes you stop yourself from making a difference in the world, that is the thing that you shouldn't be paying attention to.
A grain of sand in an oyster shell makes a pearl. Make a pearl.
Yeah, precisely. And I think it's a good one, actually. The grain of sand in the oyster shell. Much like a seed on an oak tree. And I think that's something Bill Hicks said. I'm just planting seeds. If they take root and they bear fruit, I don't know. I'm just feel better planting them. And this is a great approach, I think. Because what truth is in a lot of them, and I think one of my colleagues did a show about what's called truth of snobbery, where we start thinking we're better than everybody else.
They're all sheep and I'm not.
Yeah. The problem is, ladies and gentlemen, everybody else might be a slave, but that doesn't mean that you're free. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
That's what you are. Unforgettable. Though near or far, like a song of love that clings to me, how the thought of you does things to me. Never before has someone been more unforgettable in every way.
Welcome back.
And
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I also want to encourage people that I've got a very eclectic taste in music, some of which old, some of which new, some of which obscure, some of which popular. And I think that's because it reflects my social circles. A lot of my friends are a lot older than I. And I think of that Nat King Cole song, Unforgettable. Have you ever seen the film Watchmen, Thomas? No? Oh, it's a great movie for a truther, I think. It's a superhero movie kind of thing, except it's a lot darker than the average superhero movie. It's really violent, and there's a lot of conspiracy and skullduggery and scumbaggery going on in there. High technology, the whole thing. And one of the opening scenes of it is these two superheroes having a really, really massive fight, and one of them being killed, and the theme music for it is Nat King Cole's Unforgettable. You know, so as they're flying around the room, breaking through tables, having their heads slammed through granite bench tops and things of that nature, it's just din, 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 I like it when people put ironic music, you know, like music that doesn't fit into something completely different, and yet somehow make it work. And I think that is one of the most wonderful things about this show as well, is that we make terrible, terrible things easy to digest and actually fun.
Well, that's how you get through it. It's funny you mentioned that. The first film I remember where they used that technique was American Werewolf in London, because I had heard it was this incredible horror film, and I went to see it, and it starts off with that blue moon, you saw me standing alone, and you're expecting to see someone's head being ripped off or something, and it was a genius, ironic start to a film. So it's the same idea. That Nat King Cole song is so beautiful, it's almost hard to even believe that they could capture that much beauty on one record. I love that song. It's absolutely gorgeous. I have very eclectic taste in music as well, but I like anything that has a sense of honesty in it. I don't care if it's death metal, Nat King Cole, hip-hop, I don't care. Once the honesty comes through, I'm there.
Yeah. Well, I think music lovers are sort of like the people on the beach with the metal detector. They're shuffling through an entire beach of sand to find those little metallic nuggets of valuable material. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. You'll get a few you'll get a few Coke bottles tops, and you'll get a few cans. But now and again, you might find a Rolex watch or a ring or something.
Yeah. And I think this is what people don't realize, and I noticed this when I was editing a song over the weekend with my bandmate, is he kept telling me, oh man, I'm tired, it's done, let's stop editing. And I'm like, no, there's tiny little bits in there, just that there, you know. And then you listen to it again, and he's like, oh, there's another little thing there, and there. And it seems like it's endless, it seems like it's relentless. But because I was relentless, because I wasn't prepared to give up, actually managed to perfect the song, right? That's what persistence now gives us. That's what that ability to not take no for an answer, to not leave well enough alone in the positive sense of the word. That's the very antithesis to psychopathy in a lot of ways, because you're capable of persevering through your frustration, through your anger, through all those displeasures in order to create something beautiful.
Oh, yeah, they wouldn't even understand that. They would actually steal another person's song and say that they were singing and they wrote it.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And they wouldn't, to them it would be just, they wouldn't understand the process of creating it. Just take it. It's mine.
Now, here's another thing. Do they actually believe their own BS?
Yeah, I think at some levels they do. Because they think they're God. They think they're God, they think they can get away with anything. And they have, because they have, like, you know, testicles of titanium, there's a kind of a hubris there that's like, it's beyond delusion. They actually really absolutely do believe, I think, in most cases, they're BS. I really do believe that's true. That's why they can pass lie detector tests.
They can pass lie detector tests? Well, like absolutely. All of them? How verified is that?
Oh, very verified. And it actually has been shown that they can actually, the more you put them in the lie detector test, the better they get at actually dodging it.
Wow.
They don't have any kind of internal self-reflection. When they're lying, you see, what happens is, suppose a psychopath robbed the bank, right? And he was a suspect in the robbery. And they had good evidence against him, but not all the evidence. As far as he's concerned, he didn't do it because he hasn't been caught yet. That's their logic, right? Mm-hmm. The logic is, he didn't rob the bank because he hasn't been caught yet. So you put them under a polygraph, and when you ask him, did you rob the bank? Well, in their warped psychopathic consciousness, he hasn't robbed the bank because he hasn't been caught yet. You understand? It's only when he gets caught robbing the bank that he's robbed the bank. Otherwise, he's not responsible for it. There's no sense of any kind of owning up to any kind of responsibility. It doesn't exist.
That reminds me of a Robert Redford film called 3 Days of the Condor. He's a young agent, and he comes back to his office, and everybody's been killed. And he just gets left hung out to dry by the agency. And he has this conversation with a section chief towards the end of the film, where he says, "What's wrong with you people? You think that not being caught in a lie is the same thing as telling the truth."
That's it. That's exactly what they're like. This is the ass law and criminal psychologists and law enforcement agencies dealing with, like, mafia guys and stuff. That's what they're like. Henry Hill, who the movie's Goodfellas was based on. When I lived in New York, a boss I had, when I was first starting out, I used to house paint houses. And my boss had the painting contracting company, and he used to do contracting work for Henry Hill and that gang that were in the Goodfellas movie. And he said Henry Hill was the most dishonest person he ever met in his life. He said he would rub the eyeball out of your head, right? And unless there was some witness there apart from you, and or even video evidence, he would never admit he did it. He said he never met, in a way, that was one of the first psychopaths I can remember being told about. I didn't not have that kind of language back then to describe them. But he said to me that, like, this guy had absolutely no, to him, lying and the truth were just completely arbitrary. He never told the truth to anyone in his life ever. And he never, ever served anyone other than himself. And that's why he turned all his own friends in. Not because he had a crisis like in that movie Goodfellas. It was simply to save his own hide.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they'll sell their own grandmother for a nickel. You heard that saying?
Yeah. When he died, I was listening to the Howard Stern show, because he used to go on the Howard Stern show a lot, and I wanted to hear what Howard Stern said about him. And Howard Stern was saying he was the most disgusting human being I've ever known. He had absolutely no decency in him. You know, he would lie, he would let you down. Like, he was supposed to appear in some Howard Stern movie, and he tried to change the contract at the last moment. He just lived in the world of swindling and lying people. He knew no other way to live.
Now, if you don't have any decency, what room does that leave for men like us? You've seen the movie The Dark Knight, and recall the interaction between Harvey Two-Face and Batman towards the end of the film, when Harvey's kidnapped Commissioner Gordon's family. And he was saying that basically we failed. We didn't get rid of the crime in Gotham because we were trying to be decent men in an indecent time. And I thought that was quite profound for me. And one of my mates has been kind of shafted a little bit lately. He's had bad relationships with his missus and all of this kind of thing. And people that he's been very generous to, giving nothing back and only taking more. And I said to him that same line, you know, that's our problem, man. That is our problem. We're decent men in an indecent time.
Yeah, and that was even shown in that movie, what was it, The Untouchables, the busting the gangs in Chicago, Elliot Ness and all those guys back in their day. And you see how it was decency and being good is what got the two who were killed, Sean Connery and the other guy. And Sean Connery, you know, the guy came to kill him, and he beat him up, and he says, "Get out of here, you scumbag." He goes, you brought a knife to a gunfight. And what he did, because he let the guy go, it gave the guy with the machine gun on the roof a chance to shoot him. It was the act of humanity is what brought the two guys down in that film. And that's what that film really showed. And it was a pivotal scene in there. It was actually based on a Russian silent film where the actor, I forget his name, he was a big star back then, the dark, good-looking Italian guy. And he grabs a baby that's going down in a baby carriage down the steps, and he has to make the decision to save the baby and put himself in danger. And he saves the baby and he kills the bad guy. And that was the pivotal point in the film where compassion finally paid off for the cops.
Mm. Now, unfortunately, it sort of works the opposite in the system, right? I've said for a long time that justice is not a natural state. It certainly doesn't exist in nature. You know, you never see a lion being killed by a herd of gazelle or something like that because the lion ate one of their babies, do you? No, it doesn't happen.
I disagree.
No?
I disagree. There are videos on YouTube, believe it or not, Finny, that show herds of wildebeest beating the crap out of lions.
I've seen that video. There's even it
doesn't happen all the time, but there's a great metaphor and lesson there for us.
Yeah.
There's one where you see a zebra saving her baby, and it actually kills the lioness. Mm. It stamps on it while it's under the water. And that shows you that even in the natural world, this Darwinism stuff, it's not necessarily true.
I'm arguing something different here. Because I'm talking about justice, self-defense, and herd mentalities, vigilante justice. That's what exists in nature. But a trial, facts, evidence, corroborations, testimonies, fairness, an actual system, so that if somebody is murdered or their private property damaged or stolen or something of that nature, there is a comeuppance for that person without the necessity for violence necessarily. There'll be a civil way of proceeding things, and that certainly doesn't exist in nature. It's called the law of the jungle in the nature, and we've created a completely different system. Now, our system would work if it was actually applied. You know what I'm saying? Because the problem is we've got psychos running the judicial system, psychos making all the laws and manipulating everybody into following all of this BS. Whereas the very concept of it, at its core, the lie that they tell everybody, if that was true, it would be great. But it can only be made artificially. Right? This is why I don't believe necessarily in that karmic idea of good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people, because I don't think that you can actually rely on nature to do that for you. You either have to do that yourself, or you have to have a system that is not corrupt in order to enforce that will and to make society fair, make society just, make society safe.
Yeah, it's the wisdom of Solomon thing. We don't have, like you said, the justice system, if it worked as it was applied, it would be wonderful. It would be absolutely a utopian in terms of delivering a sense of fairness in society. But as you said, it's corrupt. So what happens, so this is also why there are no psychopaths in indigenous cultures. They just don't exist because they kill them off. As soon as they recognize them, they kill them because they realize that the whole tribe is in extreme danger because of this one parasite in there. And so he'll be thrown off a cliff or something while they go on a hunting trip. Whether he'll be used as bait or something. But
this reminds me. This is something I wanted to ask you, Thomas. Should being a psychopath, a clinically diagnosed psychopath, be a death penalty offence? Because you cannot possibly be of use to humanity if you're a psychopath, and there's no coming back from that. Like, I was wondering of that idea, and I find it poses too many moral grey areas to ever institute.
No, I would be totally against that for a few reasons. One, I think everyone is entitled to human rights if they're human, so they can't just do it. That's like eugenics. That would be just like eugenics. And they would, and you know what happened, Vinny? They would kill the poor psychopaths, and the rich ones like Tony Blair would still get like knighthoods. Do you know how the system works yourself? Yeah. So they just extrapolate the current justice system to that. But also, I think you can teach them Pavlovian conditioning in some cases, that like, do, you know, behave yourself, and sometimes you can get them stopped. We'll talk about it later.
Indeed. We'll be right back.
Jump rope, double dutched and turn on the mic with a thumb stroke, subtle touch, cuddle clutch. Is this thing on like the flame with Mrs. King Kong this spring gone? Sing a song of slap happy crappiness. He came to blow like it was strapped to his nappy chest. Surely I jest. The best on a wireless mic, not an eye test. Yet I digress. But why stress? Try and remember when maybe bit the tender skinned baby silly Gwendolyn. The type to hit
and welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to about the show that's about getting depressed and then going through with a digress. My very special guest is, hey, that rhymes three times. Hey, I just rhymed again. And there's Thomas Sheridan, who wrote the book Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. And I do believe that your research material and the interviews that you've done over the years have made a fracking huge impact, right? Like, it can't be calculated nor underestimated, I think. And I wonder, do you recognize the importance of yourself? Do you realize what a great man you are?
Well, I don't know, really. I don't know. I live in a country and I live in a small town where no one knows who I am. But occasionally, like when I go to a city like Dublin, people stop me on the streets and it shocks me. Oh, you're Thomas Sheridan. I've seen you on YouTube or I've seen your videos or I heard you. So it is quite amazing to me. No, I'm not aware of it because it's just the kind of person I am. I live in a kind of a bubble in my own mind, and I'm not really aware of my impact around the world until people tell me these things. And there's something wrong with me that way, and I still don't kind of believe that. And I says, it's not really true. I'm not being deliberately humble or anything like that. It's just my nature. I've always been kind of like that. I'm unbelievably easygoing. You know, I'm just really am. It's probably a good thing because it keeps me out of trouble.
Well, it's a musician thing. Musicians take criticism sometimes personally, but they also are very, very reluctant to profess how good they are, even when they're really, really good. The best musicians, at least. And I was telling my bandmate this, and he says, oh, I don't worry about getting criticised anymore. And I go, why not? He goes, because people don't criticise me anymore. Because he practices 4 hours a night.
Well, it's like I think it's an Irish thing too as well, because if you're like famous or well known in Ireland and or anything, like I'm talking about, like even you're really well known, there's, you know, even the politicians, when they walk into a pub or a restaurant, someone will say to them, oh, not this gobshite again, you know. So it's like if there's something in this culture here where you're not, it's a healthy thing too, where you're always reminded that you're no better than the rest of us. And so I think that's an inherent Irish thing. I think it's one of our better traits, that it's like it puts a safety valve on you, because you look at what happens when it doesn't work in someone like Bono. And he thinks he actually is some kind of like savior.
Did you ever see the South Park episode?
Of Bono? The biggest turd. That was a great one.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That was a classic, except the accent was terrible. But it was terrible. It was like this like hybrid South African Scottish accent. But it was like Randy Marsh had the world's record for the biggest bowel movement, and Bono beat him. And that was brilliant. That was brilliant.
And it wasn't because Bono was... what was it? It's because Bono himself was the bowel movement record. Like, he actually got where he was born, you know, as the world's largest turd, and he got sprayed and loved, and he grew, and because he knew that he was a number two, he had to be number one at everything so that he would never be number two. Nobody would ever call him number two.
those guys, when they're funny, they're genius.
Oh, yeah.
I love Randy Marsh. I love that character. He's like one of the best characters, the father. That's one of the best. He's so neurotic, but yet at the same time, you feel so bad for him.
Yeah. I'm so startled.
You know, I've got this really wacky idea that we should really start. You know how David Icke just started up this this new TV studio, right? I think a non-centralized cartoon studio with heaps of truther animators and writers and directors and voice talent and stuff from all over the world create cartoons together, truther cartoons, you know, like a South Park but on steroids.
Oh, I've been saying that for years. If we had those kinds of resources, it would be like a mixture of South Park, Monty Python, but better. If we had those resources, we'd rule the world. Well, yeah, no, it's a shame. I wish animation was brought down to the same way Photoshop and audio recording is. It's still not completely accessible to the ordinary guy, but the day it is, really good animation is accessible to us. Watch out, world. Because I'll definitely be using it.
Yeah. I mean, a program that does for animation what YouTube has done for video.
Yeah, or, you know, the music programs have done for recording to bring it, make it very accessible. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I think there are a number of programs that are capable of doing that. They automatically animate things for you. Like you can draw a head and arms and what have you, and then instruct the certain parts of the image to do certain things, and then it renders and then animates the entire image for you as if it was in real motion.
Yeah, I've seen them, but they're still kind of crude.
We're
a few years away from the big one.
But okay, it's like cameras, for example, used to cost like what, 100 G's for a you know, television / movie camera.
Yeah, HD camera would be like $300,000, not like 15 years ago.
Yeah, and now they're like, you got one on your freaking phone.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Yep.
Okay, so if it can be that easy, then surely we can come up with a technological solution to replace 500 Korean animators.
Yeah, I agree. That's the next one. That's the next stage. I'll be on that like white on rice as soon as that comes out, because I have loads of ideas for cartoons and stuff.
Oh, mate, it's going to be good. Now, this is another thing. I believe people need to adopt more creative outlets in order to go against the New World Order. Okay, so it's all very fun and fine and good to go out and start raving in people's faces and telling them about the scumbaggery and telling them you're a slave and blah, 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 9/11's an inside job, the vaccines are poison, la, 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 la. But if it ain't working and you've been doing it for 10 years, change frickin' tact. Okay? This is what people are doing. It's... I came up with a new definition of insanity. When all evidence is to the contrary and you still keep doing it, believing it'll work, that's insane.
Yeah, and it never changed tact. Write a song. Start a radio show. You know, approach people differently. That's a good one. Do it with a smile on your face rather than walking around saying, we're all screwed. Do it with a smile on your face, you know?
Sometimes you need that we're all screwed in order to snap you out of your happy little happy-go-lucky lifestyle, right? Because I think it was when I was first getting into this sort of information, it was in the fear paradigm, and it really messed me up. It destroyed my entire life, basically. You become angry, you become depressed, you become despondent, you become
apathetic. Yeah, lose relationships.
All of them, you know, they just disappear. And I think that's a necessary evil in a lot of cases. You've got to take that first step. You've got to be prepared to release all of that illusion out of your life and go through that traumatic, suffering, painful process of your awakening. Otherwise, you don't actually really see the value in going through what you went through. And as a result, you don't really keep to your lessons. You don't really take those lessons on board. And you wind up becoming the very negativity that you wanted to start fighting against.
we have to learn to understand that destruction is not the end of the world. It's an evolutionary step. It's like, I can always remember the one town I lived in, there was a factory there. And when the factory closed, everyone was like, oh, it's the end of the world, it's the end of the world. And when the factory, some people wanted to reopen the factory. And if they were like, when it wouldn't happen, they'd say it was the end of the world. And eventually what happened was they knocked down the factory and they built a beautiful park. And that was like, that factory had to die to make this beautiful park, which now employs people because they have concerts in the summer and they have events and fairs and crafts and arts fairs there. And it changed things. And that's the same thing with your life. Sometimes it's like the tarot card in the tarot. The tarot has to fall. It has to be demolished. But just because there's rubble lying on the ground doesn't mean it's going to be there forever. You have to clear it out to begin again. People have to understand that when they're going through that stage where they're waking up and they lose their friends and all that kind of thing, that's the tower falling. But that doesn't mean the tower won't rise again, and it will. And it'll be more beautiful.
Yeah. In 1776-foot-tall skyscraper owned by Larry Silverstein, the tower has come back, baby. Thomas Sheridan, I think it's thomassheridanarts.com, if I'm not mistaken. thomassheridanarts.com, ladies and gentlemen. Check out his interviews. You go Google this man. He's got great stuff all over the web.
I have a Sunday night radio show called The Philosophy of Health.
See you again sometime, folks. Thanks for listening.